Hi, everybody. Welcome back. This is Anthony Pastore. I'm sitting here in our offices in New York City, UBS, of course, 1285 Avenue of the Americas. I'm with my colleague, David Lefkowitz, Senior Equity Strategist for the Chief Investment Office. David, great to be with you.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
So, of course, this is the Chief Investment Office's House View monthly client call and webcast. Some of you may be familiar with this call and the process and the logistics, but I'll go through a couple of things with all of you before we get started to talk with David about all the things that are happening. Today also, I should fast forward a little bit and tell our audience that we will be focusing not only on the markets as they stand today, but we'll be focusing a little bit about the decade and the year ahead based on a couple of publications. I'm getting ahead of myself, David. Yeah. So here are some logistics. We'll be broadcasting this over the call. So if you're dialed into the call over the phone, you can stay where you are. We're happy to have you there. But there's also a video webcast. If you go to ubs.com/CIO Live, that's all one word, CIOLIVE, you can actually watch this. We also really, really enjoy hearing from you. We frequently get a lot of questions here into the room, and David will be happy to answer them. We can offer you an ability to do that on the phone by hitting *1. And then if you're watching the webcast, there's an ask a question button, but we'll tell you more about that later in the call. Also, just to keep you aware of the legalities of all this, we are not authorized to talk about single stocks on this particular call and webcast, but if you do have questions, we recommend that you reach out to your UBS financial advisor. I think we got all that out of the way.
Yep.
And by the way, hopefully everybody's having a really nice holiday season and a great Thanksgiving. It was just last week. It's hard to believe that we're already in December, and this is our last webcast for the House View call for the year. So we're going to go out with a bang, David. So
all
let's
right.
get right into it.
Sure.
Recently, the Chief Investment Office published the Year Ahead 2020 piece.
Right.
And it's an annual piece that everybody looks forward to. But this one also focused on the decade ahead. So we're actually entering 2020.
Right.
We've got 10 years of content coming. But I thought maybe we could start with the year of choices, which is the first section of the piece, which talks about what's coming up. And maybe we could start by talking about the connection to a recent survey, the Investor Watch, that UBS puts out.
Mm-hmm.
79% of investors said that we are entering a period of higher volatility. Meanwhile, 66% think it would be driven by geopolitical events. Probably doesn't come as much of a surprise to everybody listening in. On every single call we've done in the last couple of months, it's been about geopolitical events, elections,
right.
trade.
Right.
Does this dictate to you what the next year will bring based on what the survey participants responded with?
Yeah, I think partly, Anthony. I mean, I think the geopolitics, first of all, are always something that are a factor that can impact markets. But we have a few, I would say, hotspots now going on in terms of geopolitics. Obviously, we have the trade dispute between the U.S. and a lot of its trading partners, but especially with China. We have an election coming up in just about 11 months from now. I mean, that's going to be something key. And we still have military skirmishes around the world. And you never know when that could lead to a spark in or a spike in oil prices. So geopolitics are part of it, but it really at the end of the day, it's always about the economy and corporate profits, right? So I think the question really is, how do geopolitics affect the economy and corporate profits? And that's how we tend to look at how it impacts portfolios.
Right. Well, what about politics? The election, as you mentioned, is about 11 months away. There's already so much in the news every day about who might be running and who's jumping in, who's jumping out. You know, the White House's comments on who these potential candidates may be.
Right.
So we are all aware of that. But how much of this do you think will play into the, you know, decision on making for portfolios in 2020? Because that's probably something a lot of our clients and watchers are concerned about.
Yeah. So the short answer is, at this point, we just think it's a little bit too early to be positioning portfolios for what could happen in 11 months. But to your point, Anthony, yeah, I do think that we could see some there are scenarios where we could see some volatility. You know, look, there's been a lot of polarization between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. So whenever we see a flip in terms of either the White House or Congress, that can lead to more uncertainty and changes in tax policy, in spending policy, things that affect the real economy. So we have to be cognizant that this could lead to some volatility. I also do want to address the issue about, we've gotten a few questions from clients about, well, some of the proposals that are coming out of the Democratic primaries may be a little bit more extreme than we've seen in the past. I would just caution, it's still a very crowded field. We don't know who the front runner is going to be in and who's going to win the nomination. And we may not know for a longer than normal period of time because it is such a crowded field.
Right, right.
Also, nominees, once they secure the nomination, tend to move closer to the center, right? So it's hard to have to say a lot about what the policies will be implemented based on where we are today in the election cycle. And the last thing is, look, Congress matters too, right? So there's a lot of variables that at work, and that's why our main message here is that, look, it's just a little bit too early to really be incorporating election outcomes into a portfolio.
Right. Something else I wanted to ask you particularly about next year is, already right now we feel, and we can see the way the markets are trading, we are still near all-time highs on the equity side.
Yep.
Is there more room to grow in 2020? What's the pace look like according to CIO's research?
Yeah, so the key message I want to leave everybody is that we don't think there's going to be a recession, right? And I think as an equity investor,
that's the question that always comes up.
That's one of the questions I'm often asked in client meetings. Sure. When's the next recession? So if there's no recession, then it probably means that the U.S. equity market will continue to grow. Now, why do we think there's no recession coming? We're not seeing the ingredients that tend to drive a recession. Usually, it's two key factors. It's access to capital and imbalances in the economy. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is, when access to capital gets more difficult, in other words, when interest rates rise, when the Fed is tightening policy, then businesses tend to pull back, homeowners tend to buy less houses and things like that because it gets more expensive, that tends to slow down the economy. Right now, interest rates are quite low, right? I mean, as we all know. So that's not problematic, and banks are very happy to continue to lend. The other really important factor here is that we don't see a lot of imbalances in the economy. And what I mean by imbalances are big misallocations of capital that need to be unwound. What I'm specifically saying, think about 12 years ago on the eve of the financial crisis, it was very clear there was a housing bubble.
Right.
That needed to get unwound. And on top of that, we had an over-leveraged financial system. So the cleansing of those two issues was really why the recession was so bad. We had a similar thing happen in the late 90s in the tech sector and a valuation bubble in the stock market. Long way of saying, we don't see a lot of those imbalances today. So that's why we don't think we're going to have a recession. And with interest rates, pretty benign, it means that the expansion will continue. The one caveat here is that the growth in corporate profits going forward is not likely going to be very robust. Mm-hmm. We're only looking for about 5% growth next year. And valuations in the stock market, I think, already do reflect some of the good things that I was just talking about. So there's less scope for valuations to move up from here. Mm-hmm. So it means that gains from here are going to be very certainly going to be lower than they have been this year, and they could be pretty moderate, maybe around 5% in our base case.
All right, we'll talk more about that too when we get to our equity section.
Okay. Which sorry I'm if I'm jumping to. Ahead.
No, not at all. It's great. It's like a little bit of a tease of what's coming up next.
Yep.
I did want to ask you though, before we leave the 2020 outlook, how should investors be thinking about their portfolio then in this late cycle, low yield type of environment?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that we don't think there's going to be a recession, I think you want to just stay the course. You want to stay invested because, look, there are upside scenarios too. We were just talking about our base case. If tariffs are rolled back, that could be another source of further growth in corporate profits and further valuation expansion. So I think it makes sense to stay the course and stay invested. The other thing that's really important, I mean, there's an adage about timing the market. The most important thing is not timing the market, it's about time in the market.
Uh-huh.
Right? And the point here is that it's oftentimes very difficult you have to make two decisions right if you're trying to time the market. You have to know when to get out, and you have to know when to get back in. And sometimes it's very difficult to get both of the, and oftentimes it's very difficult to make both of those decisions correctly. And that's why we're saying, with recession risk pretty low, just stand pat.
Right, good to have a long-term time horizon. Mm-hmm. Right. All right, let's go to the decade ahead. So we're 2020 and beyond to 2030. What does the world look like over the next 10 years as far as the investment world?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of trends that we're going to see. It's going to be more urban, and that's just a continuation of a trend. It's going to be more connected, and it's not just the smartphones that we all have in our pockets, but it's going to be a lot about devices and things that are more connected as we go into the next 10 years. And maybe ironically, it's going to be more bifurcated. And what I'm thinking here is that I think the tectonic plates in the global economy are kind of shifting a little bit, and we're seeing the U.S. and China are moving away from each other, and you can almost see a world where we have a sphere that's more kind of U.S.-centric and a sphere that's more Chinese-centric. That certainly is a possibility as we go over the next 10 years. So a couple of different conflicting things, but definitely some sort of big long-term trends that'll be at play.
Right. Well, something that the report discusses is there are six key transformations that are expected over the next decade, and those include deglobalization, technological disruption, wealth redistribution, monetary policy 3, demographic change, and environmental action. So right. I know that's a lot to cover.
Yeah, sure.
But just if you were to take that as one bucket of ideas, how does that actually play into what the next 10 years looks like?
Right. So we focused on those particular trends because these are the things that we think can impact portfolios and also impact economic growth. And I would sort of characterize them in two buckets. One is trends that we think will persist. And so digital disruption, right? Digital, it's all about technology and innovation.
Right.
Innovation's been the story of humanity for hundreds of years. That's certainly going to continue, and it probably will continue to accelerate as we become more digital. So that's going to be open up potentially some interesting avenues of opportunity and investment opportunity. A couple of the other trends we think are going to be a little bit of a reversal of some of the things that we've seen. You mentioned deglobalization.
Yeah.
That's a reversal of what had really been in place from World War II until about 5 or 6 years ago.
What you were saying with China and the U.S., for example.
Exactly. It does seem like the world is no longer kind of converging into one trading block. It's more about kind of bifurcating and maybe even fragmenting even further than just bifurcations. And so that's a reversal. The other trend that's been pretty dominant over the last few decades has been the rise in inequality. And we think that's going to get to a point where governments and politicians begin to try to bend that curve a bit. And so we think there's going to be a reversal of the continued march of inequality. And the third thing you mentioned, one of the other things you mentioned, environmental risk.
Right.
Over the last few decades, we've just seen more and more concern about what's happening with the environment. We think that turns into more action on what's happening with the environment. So that's the lens that we've sort of been thinking about with some of these big themes.
Thanks, David. That wasn't easy to get through because there's a lot there. So thanks for doing that.
Sure.
Let's talk about returns, though. We've had a really good last 10 years.
Right.
What a bull market we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And can we expect something like that over the next 10 years? What do returns look like?
The sad news is I really don't think so.
So
the starting point from 10 years ago, it was still the sort of in the very early stages of the recovery from the financial crisis. Valuations in the stock market were still quite depressed. Corporate profitability was quite depressed. That was a very good starting point in terms of the last 10 years. The situation today is things are good. That's the good news. The bad news is it's hard to see how they get a lot better from here. So corporate profit growth is going to be much more moderate as we look over the next 10 years. And valuations, we think, are fair given the current environment, but they're higher than long-term averages. And over long periods of time, valuations tend to converge to those long-term averages. So putting numbers around this, we're depending on the market we're talking about, in the developed world, we're looking for 4-6% type of annual returns for U.S. stock, for developed market equities. That's not that high, obviously. Emerging markets might be a slight exception to that, where we see a little bit more opportunity because there's some faster growth potential. But also bonds are probably not going to be generating higher returns either. The 10-year Treasury.
Low interest rate environment. Was it at 178 today?
Yeah, usually the best predictor of returns in the bond market over long periods of time is the current coupon. Right now, 178. Yeah, so you'll probably get 2 to 3%, depending on if you're taking on credit risk or whatnot, from the bond market. So equities still look attractive relative to bonds because they'll probably earn their risk premium and do better than bonds like they usually do. But the whole scale is lower. The one other thing I would mention is where are the opportunities to try to enhance those right. returns? Alternatives could be an option there, right? So things like private equity that can take more idiosyncratic risk and take a little bit more risk than just kind of rising markets, which the tide is not going to be as strong as it has been over the last 10 years. So looking for places where you can take more kind of idiosyncratic risk, I think makes a lot of sense.
Great. Thanks, David. Something else that I saw in the Investor Watch survey they wanted to ask you about is mm-hmm. that survey participants, 65% of them said that they felt highly confident about their long-term objectives, mm-hmm. having a long-term plan. Mm-hmm. And that was versus 51% of them saying they felt very confident who didn't have a plan.
Right.
Clearly, that goes to show what we were saying before, is having that kind of long-term plan gives lots of satisfaction to, you know, from an emotional perspective and also a portfolio perspective. But besides confidence, why is it so important to have that plan and stick to it? I feel like that answer, you know, that question answers itself.
Right.
Tell us what your thoughts are on that.
So look, I think emotions can be investors' worst enemy, right? And we know there are a lot of behavioral biases
right.
that come from the emotions of managing portfolios. And it's when you have a financial plan, you have often already accounted for the fact that, like we just talked about returns, they're mm-hmm. going to be, you know, call it 5%, 5, 6% for equities. Your plan should already account for that, right? So in that 4 to 6% I was talking about, that includes probably at some point a 30% drawdown in U.S. stocks, which is typical in a recession. So that's already part of the plan. So there's no reason to panic when that does happen. You know, this is all part of the plan. I'm right on track. The other thing that that I think is also important, and we've been talking a lot about this, is thinking about your portfolio and thinking about it in different buckets. Thinking, and we call that the three L's: having a liquidity bucket, a longevity bucket, and a legacy bucket. And when you think about your portfolio in these three different categories, you can start taking different levels of risk in those three different categories.
Right.
So in your, and we call that the three L's. In your legacy bucket, which is your very long-term capital that you're not going to need for decades, you can take a lot more risk and you can ride out those ups and downs in the market and over time generate very nice returns. In the capital that you're going to need for very short-term needs, having a much lower risk profile, that you just, when you see, so what happens was when you see the markets going down, mm-hmm. you know, I don't worry about it because it's in that long-term bucket. I know I don't need to touch that money.
That liquidity strategy, that's a different story.
And the liquidity is not going to be affected by, oftentimes, because you're going to be much more conservative in mm-hmm. your liquidity strategy. It's not going to be affected by the downturn in the market, and you just sleep better at night.
Right.
We find it leads to better decision-making amongst our clients.
Great. And the last question I'll ask you, David, on the decade ahead before we get into more current mm-hmm. news is, where does the Chief Investment Office actually see opportunity in this next 10 years?
Yeah. So I would highlight maybe three opportunities, three trends. We talked about innovation and on the digital side, but you know, one of the big themes we're going to see is the rollout of these 5G networks. I mean, when we have this conversation 10 years from now, Anthony, you and I, when we're talking about the decade ahead from 2030 to 2040, 5G is going to be an old story at that point. But right now, it's a brand new story. And when you combine 5G with artificial intelligence and cloud computing and all these devices that are going to be connected
right.
on these very robust networks, there's a lot of applications that are going to fall out of that, many of which we don't know exactly what they'll be. You can think of autonomous vehicles and things like that. But the companies that are selling the arms and the axes and picks that are going to be used to build these networks and deploy these technologies look pretty interesting. The other thing is, so digital disruption. Another thing is genetics. We're really starting to see some really interesting innovations in terms of genetic therapies. The cost of these are really starting to come down. This looks like an area that could be ripe for a lot of growth and a lot of innovation. And I would just highlight one other thing: water scarcity. Population continues to grow.
Right.
It's growing in places that don't have a lot of water resources. And to the extent that we can find investments that can help take advantage, you know, sort of solve some of those problems and lead to water security, that could be another area that could be pretty interesting.
Right, and that's all part of the Chief Investment Office's long-term investment themes. There are a number of them, so if you have questions about that, make sure to reach out to your financial advisor at UBS to get more information. Thank you, David. I was just thinking, as you talk about autonomous vehicles, who knows 10 years from now, if we're lucky enough to be sitting here and doing
right.
this job,
yep.
who knows how people will be actually watching.
That's true, right?
Probably their autonomous vehicle, driving them to the store.
Right, exactly.
They can sit back and watch a video while the car drives them wherever they have to go.
exactly.
It's amazing. Thank you, David. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's get into, well, there's three words, trade, right? It's all okay. about trade. If anybody yeah. watches the news, any at time, day or night, it's always about China-U.S. trade negotiations, right. the back and forth, the uncertainty about it all, which really leads me to the question I have for you. This week, we saw announcements from the White House that there wasn't going to be any kind of a deal as imminently as we thought, maybe until after the election. Then there was a report that came out yesterday that said that that wasn't necessarily true. So again, roiling the markets as mm-hmm. we saw the reactions
yes.
up, down, sideways. How do you navigate this uncertainty, David? That's the biggest question yeah. of the day. It's yeah. really difficult.
It's challenging. I think it's challenging. And I think what's important, and this goes back to everything we do, we try to have a framework around what we do and how we make decisions. It's important to, I think, keep a framework in mind. I think, look, the framework is, I think as we go into 2020 with the election coming up, we were already talking about,
right.
that I think a real escalation in the trade dispute that leads to some sort of economic dislocation just doesn't seem very likely. I just don't think President Trump is going to want to pursue that kind of policy as we get closer and closer to the election. Now, that being said, will there be setbacks and twists and turns along the way, and will the market react to that?
More than likely,
yes, right? Yes, as we've seen.
Yes.
But I think what's important from an investor standpoint is you don't overreact to some of those twists and turns, because we've seen this time and again. Escalation, de-escalation, escalation,
right.
de-escalation. That's been the story of the last really 18 months, mm-hmm. And yet markets have continued to kind of power through here. And I think that kind of story, as we go into 2020, I also think the scope of escalation gets smaller because the president likely doesn't want to risk disrupting the apple cart on the economy right on the eve of the election.
Right, right. And you know, something else that we need to be reminded of is last year, exactly at this time, we were in a significant period of volatility,
yep.
a lot of that around trade,
yep.
but we recovered once we came into the new year. So as it's an example of what you're trying to say is,
right.
you know, you have to just kind of stay in it for the long term. Eventually the returns mm-hmm. will happen as they are, not to live tick by tick of the tape. What if sticking with trade here, what if these tariffs actually kick in on December 15th, the
right.
U.S. tariffs? What happens then? I mean,
yeah.
could the market sustain this? Could we see another Christmas Eve disaster like we saw last year?
Yeah. So I don't think we'll be a Christmas Eve disaster. But and I want to talk about why, you know, I think you're asking two questions. What happened? What would happen last year?
What
was
year,
all about that?
And what's the difference this year?
And how come it? You know, how
right.
come we're not worried about that?
Right.
Last year was all about. I think the global economy was slowing down a little bit,
mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we also had a Fed that was raising interest rates and seemed pretty kind of comfortable about continuing to raise interest rates. And you know, if you go back to some of my earlier comments, tighter monetary policy, higher interest rates, that's something that can cause a recession. And the fact that, and I think the market was saying, oh my God, the Fed might actually cause a recession
right,
here, right?
So right.
I
that
think
was the sentiment a year ago.
Yeah, I think the market was worried about that. Now, we didn't think that was a necessarily an appropriate concern, because mm-hmm. inflation's benign and the Fed could stop raising interest rates as they did and even cut. And we know that they did that too. Anyway, so the situations are very different
right.
Today.
Thank
versus,
you for clarifying that.
Versus what it was
yeah.
last year. But if we go forward with your actual question, if we go forward with the December 15 tariffs, look, I think the markets will sell off.
Mm-hmm.
I think the markets are pricing in you know, that there will not be a further tariff escalation. I think the scale of sell-off is probably more in the, you know, 5% range. But again, we go back to then what happens after that, right? Because go back to my earlier comments about the president doesn't want to go into the election year with a limping economy.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could very quickly see the two parties come back to the negotiating table and try to hammer things out.
TBD on that one. So we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah.
You know, something else that came up in the last couple of days was that President Trump threatened $2.4 billion in tariffs on products coming out of France.
Right.
So of course the EU says we will retaliate. Obviously $2.4 billion sounds like a big number, but compared to the
right.
potential tariffs on China, it's small potatoes.
Yes.
Does this concern you at all?
Yeah, I think you answered the question, right? I mean, it's relatively small in the scheme of things. I mean, $2.4 billion on a U.S. economy that's $22 trillion
yeah.
is just not, it doesn't rise to the level of something that is really worrisome. And I think the market just sort of kind of shrugged it off, and I think that's appropriate.
Great, terrific. Let's move on to earnings.
Okay.
This is really in your wheelhouse as
yeah.
the senior equity strategist on the team. We just wrapped up earnings for 3Q a couple of weeks ago. How did it go? What was your reaction after it was all said and done?
So I would say the one-liner here is that earnings were better than feared. So they were, but they were still sluggish. I mean, we had earnings growth, actually earnings contracted for the first time since 2016, very modestly. Mm-hmm. They were down 1%. But, you know, basically earnings have been flat all year, and that's what we did see again in the third quarter. What that also doesn't fully recognize, I think it's, let me rephrase that. I think it's important to recognize that that flat earnings dynamic that we're talking about right now with really no growth is really not the full picture. Because if you look at the average company in the S&P 500, the average company, and I'm talking about the median company really, mm-hmm. but the median company grew earnings by 5% in the third quarter. And really what we're seeing is some pockets of weakness in some areas that are kind of dragging down the aggregate number. But overall, I would say it was not as bad as feared, kind of in line with what we were expecting. And for that reason, because some of the worst fears were not realized, the markets took that as positive.
Is there a particular sector or sectors that you think were weaker than the average?
Yeah, so I mean, this whole year has really been a story of the haves and the have-nots.
Right.
On the have side, you've had anything consumer related. The consumer remains pretty healthy. Consumer spending is fairly good. You've got wages rising. Job market's still healthy. We got the unemployment claims came out this morning, just almost hit a multi-decade low this morning. So the consumer is doing fine, and everything related to the consumer is doing well. Software is doing fine. Internet's doing well. The pockets of weakness, mm-hmm. and where we've seen some outsized weakness, is everything related to what I would call kind of global industrials. So energy companies, materials companies, parts of the industrial sector, semiconductors. These are all the cyclical parts of the economy.
And how much of that is impacted by trade?
No one knows for sure, right?
I mean, hard to say
because I mean, some of it probably is impacting. But the other thing, it's not just trade.
Yeah.
So the reason that we're seeing
to blame it on trade because it's the biggest headline every day.
Correct. And I think that's usually what you hear about when you turn on CNBC or read the Wall Street Journal. Other factors we talked a little bit about interest rates. The Fed was raising interest rates for a number of years. That did slow down the economy. Mm-hmm. Right? You saw it in the housing market. The housing activity did slow down. So and interest rates have since reversed dramatically, and now we're seeing the benefits of lower interest. So higher interest rates were a reason that things slowed down. The trade issues were a reason that things slowed down. And also just sort of what I call the kind of hangover from the fiscal stimulus. We had the tax cuts and the spending increases at the beginning of 2018. Some of that was just a one-time shot into the economy.
Yeah.
Didn't sustain itself, and we're just sort of in this kind of hangover period. And that's also part of the reason why I think we're seeing some of the slowdown in corporate profits this year. And those things should begin to improve. Some of those headwinds begin to improve. Interest rates are turning around. They'll become more of a tailwind. We don't have this sort of hangover from the fiscal stimulus. And the trade issues, look, we think our base case is that the U.S. and China do reach some common ground. So earnings should improve a little bit as we go into 2020.
Great. Quickly before we move on, David, I wanted to ask you about forward-looking guidance.
Yeah.
So for the benefit of those watchers and listeners who don't follow the markets as much as we do, companies will often, during their quarterly earnings report, take a look at what's going to be coming up next and predict maybe next quarters, the full year. How did forward-looking guidance look to you?
Right.
And how much of an indicator of the health of the economy, or at least corporations' mm-hmm. views on the health of the economy, did you see in those numbers?
Yeah. So the forward-looking numbers, the guidance, I would say, was exactly in line with what we normally see, uh-huh. which is that corporate America is very good at this. They lower the bar, and then when they report the actual numbers, they exceed that lowered bar.
Right.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you didn't. You beat the actual number. You beat the number that you lowered. But if you look at relative to where it was before they lowered it, they just kind of came in line. So, and that's exactly what we saw with the numbers that came out for the third quarter. So, and I think that was another kind of sigh of relief that it wasn't weaker than the market was fearing.
Right. Great, David. We actually already got a question in, so I figured I'll go to that. And in the meantime, if anybody else would like to ask a question, if you're on the phone, hit *1, and then you'll be able to give your question over the phone. We'll get it fed to us right here in the room. And as I mentioned earlier, if you are watching the video webcast, there's a button on the page that says ask a question. Simply type it right there, and again, we'll get it right here in the room. In the meantime, there is a question that already came in just a is somebody who clearly has been listening to this call before and knows how to follow the steps. Do the yield curve inversions, which happened a couple of months back, David, that we've seen, do they indicate a recession is coming in the next 2 years?
Right.
It's a little specific, but what would you say to that?
So we look at, what is a yield curve inversion? It's when the yield on short-term interest rates rises above the yield on long-term
interest rates. Talking about like 3 months, six months,
so
2 years.
We look at the yield on three-month treasuries versus 10-year treasuries. Mm-hmm. What's the spread between those two rates? And we did get inverted in March of this year. It has since uninverted because the Fed cut rates. Since 1978, there's been four inversions, and all four of those have led to recessions that come. Then those recessions, typically, it does take about 2 years for the recession to develop. So we're watching this closely. I mean, you know, you don't want to say this time is different. So we're watching it very closely. But one of the key questions is, well, why does this lead to a recession? And in my mind, one of the answers to that is, it's because banks start to pull back in terms of lending, right? So if you think about what banks do, this gets a little bit technical, but their profit margins go down when we see inversions. And if they then pull back a little bit from lending because of less profitability on the inversions, because of the inverted curve, then that can slow down the economy. The good news is we're not really seeing the banks pull back in any meaningful fashion. So far it doesn't look like this has affected the real economy. It's something we're watching closely. One other point on this, again, this gets a little bit technical, but usually there's more cushion between short-term rates and long-term rates. That's called the term premium for finance geeks out there. And right now the term premium is non-existent. So we're in an environment where we're just naturally rates are just kind of, long-term rates are kind of closer to short-term rates, so it's easier to invert.
Right.
And it's not clear if an inversion has the same meaning because of that. And the last thing I'll say is the inversion was very mild, right? That's the other thing to also bear in mind. We barely got inverted. We've since uninverted. So at this point, we're sort of discounting the signal, but we're obviously watching it.
Right. And something else to point out, if you're playing Trivial Pursuit and there's a finance category, that there has never been a recession without a yield curve inversion first, but not every yield curve inversion has led to a recession. I don't know the exact numbers, so it doesn't always necessarily mean you're going to get one.
Yeah.
Right.
Since 1978, it has always led to one. But if you go back further in time.
Not necessarily.
It's not necessarily
right.
true. Yes.
Cool. Thanks, David. So please send in more questions if you like. In the meantime, we'll go back to other ones. So let's stick with yields and interest rates and go to the Fed, right?
Okay.
So we've got another meeting coming up on December 18th and 19th, just about 2 weeks from now.
Right.
What's the view from the Chief Investment Office on the direction of monetary policy since the rate cut in October? You know, when what will we see this coming month then?
We think we're just on hold.
Okay.
So we don't think the Fed's
going to cut this coming.
No. We think the Fed has been very clear that they're done cutting interest rates for now. And Powell would even use these words. It would take a material change in the assessment for them to begin moving policy in either raising rates or cutting rates. So we think nothing happens.
Great. What about next year? What's the expectation for potential cuts in 2020?
So this, I think, is really going to depend on what happens with trade.
Right.
And if we get an escalation in the trade dispute, that could end up damaging the economy, and the Fed would probably respond to that by cutting rates. But that's not our base case. So very likely the Fed is probably just going to be on hold for some time.
Great. And clearly they're remaining data dependent, as they've said for the last couple of meetings. So we'll be watching for all the economic indicators that come out. We've got the jobs numbers actually coming out.
Yep.
Tomorrow,
yes,
first Friday of every month, so we'll be looking for that as well. Really quickly, also, you talked about inflation briefly,
right?
A couple of questions back, and you know, the Fed's target inflation rate is 2%, and we're still pretty comfortably below that, aren't we? And what does that indicate about you know, the direction of the economy?
Yeah, so I think it's also important whenever I talk about this is to talk about you know, oftentimes there's debate about, well, are we measuring inflation right or what? But that's a separate issue. This is how the Fed looks at it.
Okay,
the Fed looks at it this way, and they're looking at their preferred measure of inflation is called personal consumption expenditure price inflation. It's at 1.6%. Mm-hmm. And look, so it's comfortably below their target of 2, which means that they don't have to raise interest rates if they don't want to. And that means that the expansion likely has more to go.
Right.
To be honest, I mean, this has probably been, you know, part of we were talking about the last decade, as we were talking about the coming decade, part of the reason why this last decade has been so good in terms of returns in equities is that inflation never came back, right? And if you remember, I don't know, during the financial crisis and in the immediate years after it, there was so much concern about, well, what the Fed is doing is going to be very inflationary, and oh my God, you know. And now here we are with an unemployment rate is at a 50-year low, and we still don't have inflation. It's sort of, this has been the biggest surprise in my mind in terms of the last 10 years. That has enabled the Fed to keep interest rates relatively low, and that has led to a long expansion.
Right.
So this is the question you asked is key. If we ever saw inflation beginning to move up to a level that the Fed got worried about, that would potentially spell the end of the expansion. But right now, we don't see that happening.
Yeah. Okay. Great. And it's, you know, every time you give a response, it does back up and corroborate, you know, the views of what you're saying about how there isn't any recession, at least on the immediate horizon. So thanks for doing that, David.
Yep.
And I do want to mention economic data here briefly. As I mentioned, we do have the jobs numbers coming out tomorrow. But you know, the data in the U.S. for the last couple of weeks and months has been pretty decent. You said 5-decade low on unemployment. Jobs are strong. We had the claims today near record lows.
Right.
Consumer spending is up. Mm-hmm. We've got personal consumption, as you mentioned, pretty healthy.
Right.
And also global PMI, even that is trending higher after declining since early 2018.
Right.
What's the expectation for next year when it comes to economic data? I mean, 50-year low on unemployment.
Yep.
How long can we sustain that?
Yeah. I mean, in our view, it will be sustained.
Right.
And again, just because we don't see a big disruption coming, we don't see those recession triggers really developing in 2020. I think probably the most defining feature of 2020 from an economic perspective is going to be a bit of a recovery in those areas that have been weak. We talked about how, when we're talking about earnings, we're talking about energy and materials and part and semiconductors were areas that were weak. It's very likely that we're going to see some improvement there. You look at semiconductor inventories have really been whittled down. Other parts of inventory levels across the industrial supply chains have also coming more in line with end demand. So we should see a sort of a natural snapback there. Also, the weakness in the global economy has been much more pronounced. I mean, this past year has been much more pronounced overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it looks like that area of the global economy is more poised for a bit of an improvement and a bit of a rebound. So I think the story for 2020 is going to be kind of bottoming and some improvement in some of the areas that have been weak this year.
Terrific. Again, I'll remind our audience, if you'd like to ask a question on the phone, *1. And if you would like to ask a question via the webcast website, just click the Ask a Question button. And we'll see if we get a couple more questions in here before we wrap up, David. Let's just talk about the markets here, just generally. Something that I've noticed is we follow the VIX, which is the volatility index.
Right.
And people who watch, you know, those CNBC and Bloomberg, so they probably hear about the VIX a lot. But it is still near all-time lows. And this is despite so much uncertainty and all the trade rhetoric that's been going on for 18 months. How do you reconcile the volatility index being so low, even though we've seen volatility?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen some volatility in financial markets, but we've done some work on this. I have to dust it off because we did it a few years ago. But what we found is that it's actual economic volatility has a strong correlation with the VIX. So in other words, we've sort of been in this, you know, we were growing 2%, we got up to 3%, we're growing 2%, GDP growth. We've been in this kind of 2% range with pretty regularity over the last several years. And as a result of that, I think that's what's feeding into the low volatility measures that we see in financial markets more broadly. So, yeah, the headlines can be volatile, the politics can be volatile, but the financial markets are looking at the economy, and what they're seeing is that, yeah, there's some ebbs and flows, but we're kind of just hanging around this kind of 2% growth rate for the economy, and I think that's why we're seeing the VIX where it is.
Terrific. Another question came in for us, David. Yeah. How do inflation rates impact the attractiveness of cash? You probably get this question quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes cash unattractive. I mean, there's no simple other way to say it, right? I mean, you know, if we got inflation the Fed funds rate is now 1.55, right? If you're lucky if you can get some, kind of yield like that at your bank. Usually it's much lower.
It usually is, yes.
If an inflation rate's, 1.6 on the Fed's measure, closer to 2 on some other measures, mm-hmm. you're losing purchasing power on your cash. So we recommend only allocating the cash if you really have liquidity needs that you need to meet in the immediate term, but otherwise cash does not look very attractive at this moment.
Right, great. I wanted to ask you about fixed income really quickly.
Yep.
And your colleagues in the Chief Investment Office like Leslie Falconio, Kathleen McNamara, what do they think about opportunities that are currently out there? Munis themselves have had just a banner year, crazy moves in munis. It almost just traded like stocks this past year.
Yep.
Are there still opportunities on the fixed income side, especially given that rates, as we keep talking about, are
right.
so low?
Yeah. I think you have to be very selective within fixed income because of the low interest rates. So one couple of the areas that we do think are interesting are something called TIPS.
Mm-hmm.
These are Treasury inflation protected securities. When inflation does pick up, they tend to perform nicely. We do think inflation is going to pick up a little bit,
right.
a little bit closer to the Fed's target. So TIPS should do okay in that environment. But we're sort of trying to eke out some returns from fixed income.
Right.
Senior loans is another area that we like. These are typically loans that are very senior in the capital structure of corporations. They right now have pretty attractive yields. And if we do start to see interest rates rising, which certainly is a possibility as we go into next year, not our base case at this point, they're more protected because their interest rates float. So if we do see interest rates rising, they would be more protected. So those are two areas that do have some appeal within fixed income.
Great, thanks, David.
I wanted to say one thing. I mean, look, fixed income, it's still an important part of a portfolio, right? I mean, if we think of the world in probabilities, right? We're talking a lot about our sort of a base case of U.S. economy doing okay and things kind of powering on.
Yeah.
The world is uncertain, and we could be wrong. It's important to recognize that having fixed income in your portfolio is an important aspect of it in order to dampen some of the unexpected volatility that may arise.
Terrific. Thank you, David. Another question came in. How durable is consumer spending given potential volatility?
Yeah, so consumer spending really tends to be driven by the job market. I think the one thing that's pretty reliable about the American consumer is that American consumer spends when they have money. So as long as jobs are being created and as long as wages are rising, consumer spending should remain pretty well supported. In fact, we've really never seen an environment where consumers have pulled back unless we start to see some problems in the job market.
Right.
The other thing I was going to say, or when mortgage rates start to get really high, and that goes back to the recession triggers, right? When mortgage rates start to rise and that slows down the economy, but again, it's not what we're looking for now. So even though we're going to probably have some political headline volatility, consumer spending usually holds up pretty well.
Well, it's a great segue then to one of my questions for you, which is, what's the CIO's recommendation for asset allocation? Clearly, everybody has their own risk profiles,
but right.
Generally, what's the recommendation today?
Yeah, so we think the bull market's still intact, but I'm not pounding the table here
right.
about buying stocks. We were talking about maybe a 5% return next year, maybe 10% if the tariffs are rolled back and some positive things happen. So I think having a full allocation, in other words, if you usually have 60% bonds or 60% stocks and 40% bonds, have that full and normal allocation to those asset classes. But and don't don't necessarily take a lot of deviations from your benchmarks, because we're not seeing a lot of mispricing opportunities at this point that we really want to take advantage of. So I think it's just kind of stay the course, you know, stick to what is sort of a more plain vanilla type of allocation, what your normal allocation is, and if we see opportunities, then that's when you might want to take some more action.
Great, thank you, David. No other questions have come in, so thank you for those who sent them in. So let's get to the wrap up portion of the conversation here, David. And we like to end it with the elevator question, which asks you, if you get on the elevator here right in this building with a client, or even with a financial advisor, and they ask you, David, what should I know? And you have about 40 seconds to tell them.
Okay.
What are you telling them?
Right. I'm probably going to be repeating myself a little bit, Anthony, but I think the main point is that the expansion looks like we feel pretty comfortable that it'll continue. And in that case, the downside risks in markets are not so large at this point. And I would just say, you know, stay the course, stay invested. And especially given the fact that it's so hard to time getting in and out of the markets in a way that actually generates positive returns, that given that the risks don't look too high right now, just sit tight and stay the course.
Terrific. David, thank you so much. Great to be with you today.
My pleasure.
Thanks for everything.
Thank you.
And thank you all for joining us. It's so exciting to be here with you every month, and we thank you for all the support you've given us in 2019. We're looking forward to 2020. We'll have another, obviously, this webcast the first Thursday of January, or maybe not the first Thursday because it'll be still holiday week, but maybe the week after that. We'll have to talk to all of our folks who make things happen around here. But stay tuned. We'll let you know when that's coming up. Have a happy holiday season. Don't forget, as we always remind you, follow Mike Ryan on LinkedIn. Not only are you getting insights from him directly, but from David and the rest of the Chief Investment Office team, and that comes out all the time. These guys are publishing just like crazy all the time. Blogs, reports, great content coming out, podcasts, videos, things like that. So in the meantime, David, happy holidays. Happy New Year, everybody. We'll speak to you in 2020.
Time frames may vary. Strategies are subject to individual client goals, objectives, and suitability. This approach is not a promise or guarantee that wealth or any financial results can or will be achieved. UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.